Hello, everybody, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Renee Garfinkel, your host on the New Books Network with the Van Leer series on ideas. Today, we'll be talking with Yael Tamir about her new book, Why Nationalism? Professor Yael Yuli Tamir is the president of Shankar College and an adjunct professor at the Blavatnik School of Government at Oxford University. Representing the Labor Party, she served in the Israeli Knesset, where she held multiple positions. Professor Tamir is a founding member of the Israeli peace movement, Peace Now, and served as the chair of the Association of Civil Rights in Israel. Yuli Tamir, welcome to the show.
Thank you for hosting me.
With your background on the left side of Israeli politics, how did you come to write a book about nationalism?
I've been working on nationalism practically all my academic career. When I came in the 80s to Oxford to write a PhD, the thing I was interested in was nationalism. I always felt that as a representative of the left, I should find my way within Zionism and be able to maybe balance my commitment to Israel as a homeland for the Jews with my liberal democratic values.
Well, let's take a look at nationalism. Why does nationalism have such a bad reputation?
Well, for good reason. For many, many years, nationalism was affiliated in our consciousness with Nazism, fascism, totalitarianism. We were less aware of its role in the positive side of the event: self-determination, liberation, decolonization. All these things were also motivated by nationalism. So nationalism is a very comprehensive political theory, and we usually attract our attention to its most aggressive, belligerent form, rather than to its more moderate, welfare-oriented political structure.
And what is the relationship then between the nation and the state? I want to be sure we have our terms right as we talk.
Well, the nation, and so many people in history tried to define nations and failed. The nation is the social, cultural structure that actually gives the state its raison d'etre. Democratic states, unlike monarchies or other political systems, need a people that they represent. The whole idea of self-determination is essential to modern democracy. And modern democracies search a way to define the people that are part of their politics. So it's a sort of a ping-pong game between the state and the nation. The nation needs institution. The state needs definition or demarcation. And they both fit each other. And this is why they were so resilient partners for more than a century.
And in a liberal state, well, what is the difference between the nationalist point of view and the liberal point of view?
I think the national point of view stresses the notion of identity, and liberalism, and this is a very simplistic way of putting it, but liberalism stresses freedom, personal freedom, and the ability to be authentic and a self-creator.
And in your book, you also talk about the conflict, the conflicting interests between what you call the mobile classes and the immobile classes within a country. Talk about that a little bit.
So let's go one step back and say that if we want to be our own creators, write our own life stories, be able to define the way we live in this world, we need means. We need social capital. We need personal capital. We need the ability to do the things we would like to do. And that's true for, you know, getting education, making a career, helping other people, associating for some purpose. All these things depend on our means. And in the liberal world, the people that were supporting freedom as a probably first priority always forgot the importance of providing people with the means of acting and fulfilling themselves. Now, nationalism plays a very specific role in this kind of endeavor because it gives us cultural, linguistic, historical means to define it. Even the freest person in the world define them in relations to a certain history. They speak a certain language that brings in certain memories. It's this collective dialogue that we have with ourselves that allow us to fulfill many of our more cultural, intellectual, expressive goals. But in my book, I stress the relationship between those goals, the more expressive and simple, you know, basic needs. People that are fighting for their needs have less time maybe to reflect on identity issues. And they would like to see the state supporting them in their daily life, in the most basic needs they have: food, shelter, health, education. So I'm stressing the importance of the vulnerability in order to allow us to understand with whom we should engage in order to fulfill our goals and make us freer to act the way we choose.
And it's just that idea of freedom that you go into in your book. The difference between the liberal interpretation of human freedom, which you say is a misinterpretation, and the more nationalistic expression or definition of freedom.
Yes, because I think that we are free within a context. We're not, you know, what Leibniz calls separated monads floating somewhere in the space. We are grounded. We're contextualized. We can't understand ourselves without this context. So what liberalism missed is this need that is as important as many other needs that liberalism cherished.
Right, I see. However, nationalism has the terrible history culminating in German nationalism, the Nazism, and that's pretty much what disgraced the very concept. But you argue that the social progress and the widespread benefits of post-World War II were dependent on the alliance of the nation and the state. So, please go ahead, talk about that.
Absolutely. The nation state was the only state that could develop the idea of a welfare state that takes care of the citizen and supports them in a transgenerational way. Namely, this generation respects the former generation and Putin means to support the future generation. This continuity is part of a conceptual framework that is very closely affiliated with nationalism.
And where does populism fit into the equation?
Populism is the moment where nationalists, socialists, liberals, people of all different political ideologies, I take the popular view to be the only important part of the definition of how the political system should be governed. So populism allows us to go with the mood, the spirit of the age, the will of the people, and never balance it with some basic ideas that are essential and they are valuable, even if people don't necessarily now, at that very moment, cherish them or place them at the top of their priorities. So there's a populist element always in democracy. The question is, how much of what you do is attending to the voice of the people, which is absolutely necessary in democracy, and how much you balance that voice with other values and obligations?
And among those values are those who argue in favor of the free market taking the place, or taking a lot of the place, of nationalism or of government. What's wrong with that?
Well, I think it's easier to answer this question in the post-corona or the in the midst of the corona crisis. No free hand can handle the corona. You need a state. You need institution. You need social services. Education has social support system, probably housing, probably support for the job market. You need a state. You can't, the market is good when everything is well. But when you have a crisis, when something goes wrong, the safety network is provided by the state. Now, some people, the more affluent, usually don't need the network on a daily basis. So they don't see its importance. But when you look at the people at the bottom of the heap, they need it more frequently. And they are the people that actually depend on social services on a daily basis, even when things are, as we say, going well.
Okay. Another element, of course, which you mentioned in nationalism is identity and a sense of belongingness. But human beings develop those important aspects of their lives in a variety of contexts. Family, tribe, religion, class, ethnicity. In what ways is nationalism better than any of those as an organizing principle of society?
Nationalism is an organizing principle of society, and its affiliation with the state allows it to do the things we have been discussing. Many other identities are important, but they have less of an ability to be a provider of law and order, of services, of support system, all of which are essential for our well-being and for our freedom. So we have many identities. The national identity is certainly not the only one, but it is in times of crisis and when we need it, the most effective one.
Well, you make a good case for the central role of narrative in our current political predicament, not just the coronavirus pandemic, but beyond it. So if I may, I will read the last paragraph you wrote on chapter 7, page 60. One of the reasons for the contemporary political crisis, marked by inner conflicts and social polarization, is the disintegration of unifying narratives. The combined effect of processes ranging from respect for diversity embedded in identity politics to postmodernism reinforced by a growing antipathy to the state as a mega storyteller made organizing narratives rare and less effective. One of the prime questions of this century is whether such narratives could be revived and what would be their content. I think this is a very essential point. So tell us more about it.
I think the search for a narrative, something that was the essence of the nation, became something that the people, let's say, in the heights of liberalism thought was oppressive, that we don't need a narrative. There are narratives, there are many narratives. We have to take them all in. We have to balance them. So there is some truth to the desire of people's minorities, genders, in intra-group to express their narrative. But after all this diversity, at the basis of the discourse, we have to have something that keeps us together, something that makes us willing, ready to go out of our way to help our countrymen, our fellow citizens, the people we share the story with. And as you know, people are storytellers. And unless you have a story to explain to yourself, why are you doing it? Why is this important for you? You are less likely to be part of this collective identity. And with no collective identity, there is no collective practice. And with no collective practice, there is no social structure that teaches us how to live together, how to support each other, how to become human fellows in a common endeavor.
Now, most of the national narratives that are effective seem to have been organic. I'm thinking of, for example, the Exodus story for Jews and Israelis that is a primary story that holds the nation together. But even ones that are less historically deep, such as George Washington chopping down the cherry tree for Americans, these seem to be organic. They just developed over time. Do you believe that national narratives can be manufactured?
Oh, they're always manufactured. Who knows what Washington did?
That's true.
You know, one of the, from my point of view, the beauties of nationalism, it's a very literary endeavor to create meaning by telling a story. And in this way, it replaces myth, it replaces religion, it replaces maybe personal stories we tell ourselves. And it's never true. Probably 90% of national mythology and narrative are fabricated.
Yes, but I guess it's fabricated over a long period of time. Is there any nation you can think of that created a national narrative in our contemporary time?
Many. Actually, we do it all the time because the narrative changes. So people tell the story again and again, and they tell it in different ways. And many, many narratives are very new. Even in Israel, we think the Jewish narrative, actually we are right, is an ancient one. But many of the stories we tell ourselves about the Jewish narrative are fabricated, and are fabricated for our purposes. We use parts of the history, we emphasize things that are important for us, and forget all other. So this is the way we work. We need structure. We need a framework within which we can think and work and give our life meaning. And we are very active in doing that alone and together with other people.
And what are the elements that that weave that narrative? Is it mostly newspapers and politicians, or does it come up from other parts of society?
First of all, schools, and then
right.
Churches, synagogues, storytelling within the home, national celebrations. You know, we are approaching the Independence Day, and we are approaching Memorial Day. This is all a huge production to tell a narrative. And it comes from up, down. Actually, it works only if it's comprehensive to the extent that what the state tells us, we believe, and then we tell our children. And then it's echoed in the schools and in the television series and everything around us.
Right. And I would guess, and tell me if you agree, that right now what we're observing in the United States, and have been for quite a while, is the breakdown of a national narrative, that there seems to be multiple national narratives that don't necessarily come together. Is that what you see as well?
I'm an expert on the United States, but I would say that what happened is that in the Trump era, a narrative that was marginalized came back. And now the competition over the accepted narrative is very fierce, and people are hanging to their narratives, and there is no there's no political power or social power that can allow them to put the two narratives together in a way that will satisfy both sides and give them a reason to think that they are part of one entity.
Oh, that's a very good point. Well, then how can governments begin to combine the best of liberal ideas with the best of nationalism to build a more just, inclusive, robust society?
Well, that's the most difficult question of all. Some states that have, I would say, a heritage of social solidarity, trust, civility, like many of the Nordic states, do it better than others, because they have the infrastructure to use in order to rebuild society, even when it is starting to break down. Societies like the United States that sort of privatize the narrative may find it very difficult to come back.
Yes, and also the Nordic states, until pretty recently, have had the advantage of being ethnically homogenous, religiously homogenous. They had no issue of diversity, so all of their stories, all of their narratives were one.
That's true.
They had the
privilege of being small and homogeneous. And it's harder to do it when you are large and diverse. I can tell you maybe that for me, the most interesting example is what's happened now in New Zealand, a country that is going through a lot of changes, and the narratives are being structured by a prime minister, obviously a woman, that is more attentive to the nuances and ready to integrate them in a way that I think is productive and certainly not as belligerent and aggressive as some male leaders do. So maybe the solution is a feminist one.
Yeah. Well, it's worth a try. We're in the midst of a global pandemic. And how do you see the concepts that your book deals with playing out in the real world in this extraordinary time?
Actually, very strange, because when the pandemic erupted, I was absolutely convinced that the attitude would be much stronger global actions to beat the pandemic. But unfortunately, maybe fortunately for me, because I just wrote on nationalism, the response was a national one. Country by country, states closed their borders, took a stand that all the people that are external to their borders are a threat, and started working to defend their system as a closed national system. And the best sort of attitude that they advocated was that now, as members of that group, French, Italians, Israelis, we have to take care of everybody who is in. So there is a very strong distinction between the in-group and the out-group. The out-group is not even allowed to come in. The in-group is developing more social responsibilities towards each other.
And that surprised you?
I thought that the global institution would play a greater role. Despite my own theory, maybe this is what I hoped will happen. I was proven right that nationalism, a time of crisis, a time of stress, is the strongest power. And everybody is drawn back to play the national game. I think the most indicative thing is the way how heads of states now, but even bureaucrats, all approach the nation in a very sort of, rhetoric, sentimental way, with the flag behind them, talking about the power of being together, how great and strong we should be. And this happens to different nations all over the world. It's the same picture, the same structure of speech. Even the Queen decided to go out of her way and give a very nationalistic and beautiful, by the way, speech about the strength of the British people.
Yeah, it's of course tricky to extrapolate from individual or group psychology to international affairs, but on the smaller level of individuals and smaller groups, it's certainly the case that in the presence of threat, the group turns inward and it demonizes or at least excludes the other. So what you're saying is that's what we're seeing on the national level as well.
Right. I think the demonization is something that is absolutely not necessary. It is necessary that we come together to fight whatever challenge we're facing. The demonization is the bad part of, or is the sort of an exploitation of the desire to be inward looking and taking into the more xenophobic, belligerent type of attitude. And I think the states that will do well in the crisis are those who will be very caring inwardly, but also very attentive to people outside their borders, even though they don't see them now as part of their responsibility.
You make a very good case in the book that the wise road for nations, the states to take, is one that balances both the best of the liberal ideas with the best of nationalist ideas, and it avoids the extreme expressions of both. Would you therefore call yourself a moderate?
Yes, I think I am. I think I'm a nationalist, but I think I'm also a moderate, and I am always trying to balance my national commitments with my other points of view, especially my liberal commitments, my belief that we as individuals have many layers of identity and many layers of commitments. And I want to balance this commitment and make room for all of them, even if they sometimes clash or make things difficult for those who want to keep more than one set of commitment.
Well, people often criticize moderates as being lukewarm, as lacking the fire of either extremes. It seems to me that your writings are making an increasing case that one can be a passionate moderate because it's the wise way to go.
Absolutely.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, Yuli, and I appreciate it. I think you are really a voice of reason that needs to be heard and promoted. Before you go, tell us what you're working on now.
I'm actually working on trying to understand the way that the pandemic restructured world order. And I think it goes back to the restructuring of the post-World Wars. It's a United Nations kind of a restructuring. It's about nations coming together, respecting themselves as social, political, economic units that take care of their own people, but also find way to collaborate with others in order to make the world better, but also to tackle the issues that states and nation states cannot deal with on their own.
Well, that's a big challenge. I wish you a lot of success with it. And I look forward to reading what you have to say on this challenging time going forward. Yuli, thank you so much for your important work and for being on the show today.
Thank you.
And thanks to our researcher, Bela Pasikoff. Bye-bye.